This week on Art in the Air features mixed media sculptural textile artist Susan Hensel, whose embroidery reaches across digital and manual platforms to exploit the physics of light, producing playful and beautiful works of art. Our spotlight is on Beach Boys tribute band Sail On with band member Mike Williamson, discussing their November 14th concert in Munster at 7 p.m. for Lakeshore Concerts.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight. They'll be coming to the Munster Auditorium in November. Just heard a little bit of their music from a Beach Boys. No, that wasn't the Beach Boys. That's Sail On, the Beach Boy tribute. And we have Mike Williamson, who's the keys and vocalist, and he's going to tell us all about their concert and what's going on. Mike, welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Hey, so glad to be here. Thanks, you guys.
Well, tell us a little bit about Sail On, how that came to be, and your current concert tour.
Yeah, so many of you seem to be like located in Nashville. Had you met prior to auditions, or how did it all happen?
Well, the band is based, is headquartered in Nashville, but no one is from Nashville, of course, as you know, Nashville is a little bit like Los Angeles in the way that it attracts people from a wide, far and wide to pursue music. And that's kind of the story with this band. It actually grew out of an original project that was a sort of a 60s era pastiche type thing, but it was all original music. And we had all done Beach Boys songs in the past in various incarnations of bands. And then we all got together. And the idea had been bouncing around for a long time about maybe doing a full set of Beach Boys songs. But of course, that is a task that no sane person undertakes willingly to try to do a whole set, you know, because of just all of different, you know, from going from the surf songs all the way out through the sophistication of Pet Sounds and Smile era. And, you know, even in, you know, the Beach Boys career spans when you think about it. I mean, just the catalog is so dense. Most people think of the Beach Boys as the 60s hits catalog, the golden age. But there, you know, there's a lot of content. And so all of that to say, it's a very daunting task to take on a full Beach Boys set. And so we finally got around to, hey, well, let's go for it. Let's really try it. We should just at least see if we could do one. And we got an excuse to do it in the way of a promotional show. And so we went all in, and it was such an incredible challenge and such a success that it was something that we knew we wanted to pursue. So full time.
And how did the members come together? You know, how did you, you know, because I see from your bios online here, you came from a variety of different places. So how did you all hook up?
I think I read that all of you were toured with Brian Wilson at one point.
No, none of us have ever actually toured with Brian Wilson or any members of the Beach Boys, but various members of the band have been affiliated with, you know, the periphery, I guess, of the Beach Boys camp. Some of Brian Wilson's band, they've been very, you know, gracious as friends and supporting us back when we were doing our original music. as I said, in different aspects, you know, different bands and things like that. And so we got to meet those guys. It's like any, like Star Trek or like any fandom or Star Wars or anything like that, or, you know, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, there is definitely a network of players and of enthusiasts, which we all are still. And so that's kind of the foundational element of it all. And as we did that music and knew of one another, and then we came together, as I said, in a couple of different original projects, we just developed the idea of, hey, let's do the whole Beach Boys thing. There we were. Matt Thompson from Indiana, he had done a Beach Boys group in college, and Wyatt Funderburk, who hosts the Sail On podcast, you know, he's a lifetime Beach Boys aficionado, to say the very
least. It's a very interesting podcast.
Yes.
Oh, great. I'm glad you like it. Yeah. He's an encyclopedia, just not about the era, but particularly about the Beach Boys. And the same thing's true of Paul Runyon. You know, he had, through various things, he played with several different oldies acts, Mark Lindsay of Paul Revere and the Raiders, things like that. But just guys were all fans of the music and had been, as I said, in the periphery or just in the network of Beach Boys enthusiasts and Beach Boys influenced music and all that kind of thing. So that's, we just sort of connected through that. And same story for myself. You know, I had been there and my whole career, I've been doing things that are kind of Beach Boys related or 60s related. So we just got it together and managed to fill a niche in the market, because it is a difficult set list. I mean, it's a very complicated thing to take on, because as I tell everyone, you talk about doing just regular pop songs and then add a 4-part harmony onto everything.
Right.
So, you know, it's not something that, it's very common that in the world, even of tribute bands, you know, where you have lots of Beatles fans and Eagles fans, things like that. There's a lot of tributes, but there aren't a whole lot of Beach Boys tributes that do it on a full-time level, sort of at the level that we do, because it's a tough thing to cover the span of material and to do it justice. And that was the thing. I think that's what keeps everyone
so energetic too.
Well, thank you. We have to, you know, it's all the different aspects of performance. You know, we have to put on a show, and we have to also try to faithfully bring the songs to life. And so it's a lot of work, but it's incredibly rewarding, because we get to play, you know, some of the best songs by an American artist and the whole canon of pop music at every gig. So
we have about 30 seconds left. Do you guys do costume changes through the years into your concerts?
Yeah, we don't do like a Broadway style costume, you know, chronology. We try to reflect essentially the two different aspects, like, you know, the early years and then a later years look.
Real quickly, tell us about your upcoming concert in Munster.
Yeah, we'll be there on Monday, November the 14th. And then we're going to be in Bryan, Ohio on the 15th, the following night. So, yeah, we'd love to have everyone come out, because it's really fun and the season's winding down. So we better get our beach party in now, or we're never going to do it.
Well, Mike, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. That's Mike Williamson of Sail On. They'll be at the Lakeshore Community Concerts Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. You can contact Lakeshore Concerts. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Susan Hensel to Art on the Air. Susan is a multidisciplinary artist with a long-established career. She combines mixed media with digital machine embroidery to create beautiful sculptural forms flooded with color. Susan has to date over 200 exhibitions, more than 30 of them solo, 20 of them garnering awards. She creates to communicate stories through art, and that continues to be a powerful motivator for her. Susan's work is known and collected nationwide and is represented in collecting libraries and museums. She's the owner, curator of the Susan Hensel Gallery in Minneapolis. Thank you, Susan, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Susan, how we like to start our interviews is kind of find out your entire story, your background, you know, growing up, where you went to school, everything, you know, early arts experiences. And I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Okay. Well, I was born in 1950 in Ithaca, New York, which is at the foot of Cayuga Lake in the Finger Lakes. So that affected me hugely because everything about Ithaca is gorgeous. And you see the passage of time in the shale, in the fossils. And there is now a bumper sticker that is Ithaca is gorgeous. And it is. It's very beautiful. Tremendous numbers of streams and waterfalls, water everywhere. I managed to travel around the world by the time I was 13 because my father taught in Taiwan for a year and we were able to come the rest of the way around the world. So technically, I've been around the world.
Well, how old were you when you were in Taiwan?
I was 12. I did seventh grade there in a convent school with a bunch of Air Force kids, which was an unusual situation for a little Ivy League daughter. It was a little odd. My brother went to a boarding school that was for Baptist missionaries, which was very odd for him, for 10th grade. And my sister was in the American school in Taipei. So we were all kind of separated during the year.
Can you describe your experiences there? Because 12 is it's a time where you really do have memories of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was physically unbelievably gorgeous. It reminded me in a lot of ways of New York in that it was very hilly, very, very green. It was absolutely foreign. I didn't speak the language and we were made fun of for our big noses. I can't remember what the Chinese word was, but we were all called, oh, it's the big noses. And there were open sewers. They were called Binjo ditches. And that was a big deal for us because people just dropped their trousers and used the ditches, even in the capital city. I remember my brother looking out the window of the hotel we were put up in the first night and just screaming because people were peeing in public. So that was amazing. The rice paddies were smelly and beautiful. Human sewage was used as the fertilizer for everything. And the vegetables were gorgeous. And you had to wash them in chlorinated water. And you had to boil your water. But as a consequence of all of this, there was a green that I've never seen elsewhere except kind of late spring. You know how spring green is like a lime green glow?
Right, the new spring green. Yes.
Yeah, it's really amazing when the trees just begin to burst. Well, you take that down to more of a grass green and you put it everywhere and it looks like velvet everywhere in Taiwan. It was astonishing. And the design work, the pottery, the wood carving, the brass work were just captivating to me.
And in abundance too, I imagine.
Oh, everywhere, just everywhere. And that aesthetic is reflected in my work throughout my life in odd ways. When you actually look at it, you begin to see a little bit of the Asian aesthetic in there.
And did your food palette, have you continued with, that food palette that you experienced there? Do you still enjoy the food?
I don't work with green that much, but green for me is one of those colors that it feels like my spirit color. I take a big deep breath when I see green, mm-hmm. that kind of green, and I relax and it's just something I need to have in my life. So I'm not going to be living in the desert. I do know that. When we flew into Hong Kong from Taipei, when we were leaving, I was a little sad about leaving, but then we flew into the islands around Hong Kong and it was green velvet again. So I still felt at home. But I also was 12, so I was daydreaming about Troy Donahue and various movie stars and things too. You know, so I was a typical 12-year-old in that way, but I was an atypical 12-year-old in that I was absolutely agog at the sights and the scents and the sounds.
What were the classes like? Did you have art classes, or what was the schooling like?
The schooling was odd. I was one of two seventh graders, and we just did kind of what the nuns thought were normal social studies, and they would lecture us about not wearing spaghetti straps, because that was much too outre, that was way too sexy. They had lectures about things like that to third graders. And we had to wear socks with our sandals, even though it was 95 degrees and 90% humidity. Wow. Because toes were too sexy. You know, I don't know. We were little kids, you know. I did get to go speak French with the Mother Superior from time to time, which was lovely. And there was a little Filipino nun who took me under her wing, because it was the only place in my schooling that I was bullied. Because I was the only physically mature kid there. And so I was bullied for having breasts and all of that. And there was this lovely little Filipino nun who was the shape of a basketball. And she showed me where the piano room was, and I would just practice every lunch hour, which was lovely. She was kind of my salvation. Yeah, yeah. So that was Taiwan. I have no idea what I learned in school, other than sometimes kids are mean. And
especially groups.
Yeah, you know, which is what we all get to learn. And then came home and had a little bit of a rocky return to what we now call middle school, but that got straightened out. And the rest is history. I mean, Ithaca had a really
rocky because you were the new student back in town.
Rocky because initially I was not put in the right track. We were still tracked then, and I was put in just kind of a general track, and my parents had kind of an uproar about that. So then I was put in the college track, and that caused some problems with girlfriends, of course. But then the following year, they eliminated tracks. So I got to take the same English course again, you know. So, you know, it was kind of typical 13-year-old garbage. You know,
right.
High school was much better.
It's a very intense time.
It is. I've always said, if there is a hell, it is called being 13.
13. And then coming from a foreign country and a completely different experience. And it has to be a bit of a cultural shock for you, too, coming back.
Oh, yeah. To just come back. Yeah. To all these, some of the kids, you know, the Cornell kids, some of them had traveled because of sabbaticals and things. But there wasn't this sense of the world among most 12 and 13-year-olds.
Right.
You know, there just isn't. You know, at that age, they're just beginning to realize there's a little more out there. And I had that deep experience. I'd walked on the Parthenon. I'd gone into the pyramids. You know, I'd been in Florence. I'd been in St. Peter's. I didn't get in the Louvre. It was closed. And London was on a bank holiday the one day we were there. But I'd had all these experiences that had not yet even occurred to most 12 and 13-year-olds.
So as you're visiting all these places with your family, what are you doing in those places? Are you visiting museums? Because it sounds like it was very briefly in each of these places.
It was very brief, but my parents were both educators, and so they had it planned out. And I had a good grounding in ancient history and in mythology, and because that was part of the school system in Ithaca, you just did that.
Right.
And I can remember being astonished at walking on the Parthenon and realizing how many thousands of years ago people were walking here, and they had built this, they had carved these statues, they had developed this mythology and all of these stories to make sense of their world. And here I was walking among them.
And it was there. I mean, it was there day to day. I know, it's phenomenal. I know.
And it was just mind blowing. And I felt the same way in Egypt. Egypt was difficult because it was so different, so hot, so dry. And we were robbed immediately. Hmm. But yeah, but I had that same sense of time to realize that these pyramids were built by human beings to house their gods. And we did go to the museums there. And I grew up going to museums. You know, this is what my family did. And I remember the museum there and seeing the mummies and seeing the trove of treasures that had been buried with the mummies to assist them in the afterlife. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, very moving.
It was amazing.
In middle school, back, kind of back stateside beside your travel, and even in Taiwan, did you have any early art experiences that helped you? Or how does art kind of come into your life?
It's always there. My mother grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and went to the Toledo Museum Art School all through her childhood. And so that was a part of her life. And she was a good amateur watercolorist. And I always wanted to paint like my mother. And the family story is that instead of painting like my mother, I did the typical thing of drawing on the walls. You know, I think we all do that at some point. But my urge to draw and to assemble things was overwhelming. We were all given scrapbooks on our very first sabbatical, which was in California, which is where I did kindergarten. And we were all given scrapbooks to put our postcards in and things for driving across the United States. I drew in mine. I definitely stuck things in, but I also drew princesses, you know, with fancy crowns. And it was just always there. We had a decent art program in the Ithaca schools, not phenomenal, but more than the kids get now. That was considered a normal part. And we had an extraordinary music program in the Ithaca schools. I sang in operettas.
Wow.
You know? And in our church, when I was a teenager, I sang original music that was composed for our choir by the students and professors at Ithaca College. And we traveled this music. We performed in New York City and up and down the East Coast. So it was a very rich experience growing up in that town and having those experiences.
Did you perform in any like musical theater?
Only through church, really. I was not the chosen child once I got to high school because I was not a typical teenager. I was short.
Oh, okay.
I was short. And they wanted me to be the mom, and I didn't want to be the mom, you know.
You didn't want the character roles, huh?
No, I didn't want the character
roles. Meeting you like right now, though, I think you've probably been a great character actress, though.
Oh, probably would have been, yeah. But, you know, the part of me that you don't see is the highly introverted part, which I think most actors will tell you that they are.
Right.
And, yeah, and it was big time in junior high and high school. I had my little coterie of like-minded people, you know, and that's what I had. But I had a great art teacher in high school. I had some wonderful experiences. My parents made sure that I had the chance to go draw from live models at Cornell, even though I was underage. And they also arranged for me to study with Wayne Thiebaud when he came as a visiting artist to Cornell one summer. And I had no idea who he was. He was like, well, I'm not going to treat you any different than anybody else. I said, I don't expect you to. I'm 16, whatever, you know. and then my high school art teacher showed me a flyer for studying in Perugia, Italy. Mm. And I would get to study Italian language. I would have cultural experiences and boy experiences. But I also went to the art academy there, and I brought it home to my parents, and they said, you pay half of it, we'll pay the rest. Unbelievable. So I got to spend, I think, 2 months in Italy with chaperones and boys and more boys and more boys.
That's a whole bunch of delicious.
Oh, it was. It was just phenomenal. I loved it. And then I went to University of Michigan. And it was an exciting time, 1968. They had a whole bunch of new, exciting professors who all came in from the East Coast for their first jobs, you know.
And they also had a really vibrant women's studies program always.
Yeah, that started, kind of late in my time there. And that first year was really amazing. And then I learned something about Michigan, which is they don't support the arts or education. And so they cut the budget the next year and all of those professors left. And we were left with the old guard, many of whom were spectacular, but it became a little less exciting. And it was the Vietnam War and there were protests and riots and the women's movement started there, which was exciting. And that's when women's studies really started happening. And I do have some of the original textbooks from back then, Psychology of Women from the early women's studies programs. Art history was magnificent there. We had some phenomenal professors. And so it was a really good experience. I came out, even though it was an odd one in some ways, I came out with a major in painting and a major in sculpture and an almost major in ceramics and a minor in psychology and probably art history too. I took it all the way through. And I went on to work in clay for probably 20 years doing the art festivals in Michigan.
What were you producing? Was it sculptural or functional or both?
It was functional initially. I worked in porcelain and some of the ideas that I had then still resonate today. I am always interested in providing an experience for the user or the viewer. And I want that experience to help them be more present. And so when I was working with clay, the idea was that I would develop dinnerware that would make people more conscious of the dinner event, that they would be more conversational, that the food would be more beautiful, that they would be more mindful.
Yeah. I personally think the food is much more delicious on eating off of something that someone has made.
Oh, all of my dishes are handmade.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of them, except for a couple things from my grandfather, you know, that I treasure because they were my grandfather's.
Sure.
Yeah. But no, I eat off of handmade dishes always, always. And I got rid of all of the commercial dishes when I moved out here. I donated them to friends, kids going off to college, things like that. So met my husband not too long after I graduated and we stayed in Michigan. He died in 83 and I raised my kid there. And as soon as he went off to college, I'd always told myself, as soon as he goes to college, all bets are off. I forgot. I kind of forgot. But I had a show in New York, maybe his first or second year of college. And I spent a week in New York. I stayed with somebody that I had met at Haystacks Mountain School of Craft, and we remain really good friends today. And I set up my show. I went everywhere in New York, gave myself shin splints. You know, I hadn't been in New York in like 30 years, so it was tremendously exciting. And when I came home to Michigan, I was in East Lansing, Michigan. I cried. And I didn't know why I was crying, and I'm not much of a crier. And it was menopause, but I thought, no, it's not that. Now your kid's been at school for a while. No, it's not that. And I suddenly realized I needed to move. And I couldn't believe it. It was horrifying. So I went to my son's therapist and I said, oh, Roberta, I think I need to move. And she said, yes, you do, Susan. I go, no, really? You know, and I went to my business partners. I was in a three-person gallery. And I went to them. I said, oh, Nancy, I need to move. She said, yes, you do. Why? Why didn't anybody else tell me this?
Not you.
I know. We like to tease ourselves. I had thought I could stay there and just fly out as needed. There are a lot of really wonderful artists in Michigan, but there's very little cultural support for the arts. And I'm not even talking about money. I'm talking about about thinking about art as being essential. I had to tell everybody who worked in the auto industry that the cars, the shape of the cars were designed by artists. They went to school with me at University of Michigan, you know, and the Dixie cup that they're eating their ice cream out of was designed by an artist. They went to school with me at University of Michigan. And that, do you like movies? Yeah. Artists work in the movies, you know. Yeah. So that it just wasn't there, you know. And the budgets were being cut for museums and for orchestras. Orchestra Hall in Detroit was shut down. Detroit Art Institute was shut. Half of the collection was unavailable every other day at that time, and it was time to go.
You're listening to Art on the Air with our guest today, Susan Hensel, on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So how do you choose? So did you pull out a map or did you have an idea of where you belong?
Well, you know what's interesting, Esther? For years, I had been collecting information. For many years, there were articles about the art scene in various cities in Art News, and I would just kind of keep them if they looked interesting. And about the time my son turned 10, I started attending various conferences and workshops around the nation, and I would check out those places and ask questions. And about the time I was realizing that I really needed to move, my old college roommate, who lives here in Minneapolis, called and said, well, Dale and I are coming through your area. We've been off in Canada bird watching. How about if we come down and visit? And they came down and visit, and we had the conversation, which was, Gwen and Dale, I think I have to move. They said, come visit. And so I came to visit, and it was wonderful. They showed me around, and I came back in the winter and stayed in a hotel with the dog, because you have to figure out if you can do frozen dog in winter on your own. You know, and I could. And so then it took me about 6 months to get out here at that point. It was a little terrifying because I found a place before my house sold. So I had two mortgage payments, which was terrifying as I'll get out. But I finally sold the place in Michigan, and I moved here in 2004, which was just a wonderful thing to do. Arts in this community are part of the foundation, which doesn't mean any more people go to museums than anywhere else, truthfully. Although every time I go to the museum, it's pretty darn busy, so which is lovely.
So that's the year you opened your gallery as well, right?
Yes, it is. Part of the reason I opened the gallery here, there were several reasons. One was I wasn't finished with gallery work yet. The art department in East Lansing lasted, I think, 2 years. And then one of the partners decided she needed to move on. And I wasn't quite done, but I learned a lot. I learned a lot about promotion. I learned a lot about shows. I learned a lot about media. And I also knew that I needed to get inserted in this community quickly. And it was a good way to meet people. And, you know, I had my old college roommate here. And I had one artist who I knew from Haystack, who's a friend, but she's far enough away, we don't see each other much. And through having the gallery, I met more people, and I met people in my neighborhood and made, you know, a really good friendship group here. So that was one of my key things, that and wanting to show artwork that maybe couldn't find a home, but still had a story to tell. And because I owned the building, all I had to support was my expenses. You know, I'm going to pay the mortgage regardless. So I didn't worry about paying the mortgage from the gallery. I just worried about paying the direct expenses. And it worked out just fine.
So was that also your studio, or was it?
It is now, yeah. The interior space is just studio now, and it has been for maybe 5 or 6 years. Because ultimately, running the gallery took too much away from the studio. And I loved running the gallery. Yeah. And I loved the studio. And I loved the gallery. But I really needed more uninterrupted time in the studio. And so I shut down the gallery program. But the building has huge shop windows. So those continued. And I just put anybody and their brother in there for the community for several years. But during the pandemic, I decided that it was time to resurrect the gallery, but to do it online. And so the gallery resurrected its program as a program focused on Midwest artists devoted to materiality and the work of the hand on artsy.net, which is an international, the first real international marketplace for galleries. And so my goal is to get Midwestern artists seen and sold, and little by little. And we've had some sales and a lot of being seens. So they all go home with lots of press citations. And if they're smart, you know, they've grown their Instagram from it and all of that. And they can use it to get other shows. So that's good.
It is great.
Yeah. And interestingly, the work that I'd done in person with the Susan Hensel Gallery wasn't forgotten. I joined the Odetta Gallery in New York, and we had various Zooms as it was getting set up online. And I had people there saying, you know, I showed with you. Or, you know, so-and-so showed with you. And there were names I remembered. And it was interesting that it still lived on. So, yay.
I know there's it's wonderful that there is this online forum, which then opens up, because I also have an art gallery performance space, and you're limited by who walks through the doors when really the work is just, you want the work to be seen on a global scale.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so now the shop windows, generally speaking, have my represented artists. So it's either slightly different work than they have online, or it supports what they have online. The past summer, I did a show with one of the first artists I represented. She basically had a show in three locations. So it was like a vast retrospective. She was picked up by a local bricks and mortar gallery. And then she had a specialized group in my windows and another specialized group online. So we basically got to show everything she has ever done, which was wonderful. So, yeah.
So you're serving the role of the curator actually still.
Yeah, I am.
For that. And but this all also allows you to now still create using your, what was your gallery space, is your studio space. And maybe describe some of what you do. I'm intrigued by one thing I saw in your interaction of structure, embroidery with lights and scattering, and almost like the science of it.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, I know. It's utterly fascinating stuff. And I never expected to be doing this. I mean, I like fiber, and I've always had a sideline working in fiber on and off, you know, throughout my whole life. But one year I was at the Minnesota State Fair, the biggest state fair in the United States, maybe. They tell me it is. It's huge. I know that. I've never seen anything like it. And I went to the demonstration building where they sell, you know, Ginzu knives and, you know, food preservation systems and things. And I turned a corner and there were these sewing machines sewing away, making a Donald Duck hands-free with a blue jacket. I didn't care about Donald Duck. I didn't care that it was hands-free. That blue was the most ultramarine blue I have ever seen in my life. It was an epiphany. And I had never thought of myself as a colorist, but from that moment on, I had to have that technology. And I am an engineer's daughter. I love technology. You know, so this
machines,
is not a, this is not a barrier to me. And it took quite a while of applying for grants and loans and things to get started. I finally got a loan for my first machine, and then I got a Jerome Foundation grant to get the first software so that I could learn to make my own designs. Because this technology is mainly used to do things like the Lakeshore Public Media on your jacket, you know? Yeah, that's what it's mostly used for. And I wasn't really interested in putting things on jackets and t-shirts and hats. I wanted to promote that color somehow. And nobody was really teaching any of this other than how to put it on your shirt. And I found books here and there and some craftsy classes where I could really dial down on the instructions and say, okay, but what does that mean? And what does that mean? What is an underlay? Why do we have it? What is it? How does it work? You know, and so I got some of the basics, fulfilled my grant by the skin of my teeth. It was really hard to learn the software when you don't understand the structure and you have nobody to teach you.
But I've no YouTube videos.
Yes. And there weren't any really other than here's how you put the teddy bear on your sweatshirt. Well, that's not the issue. The issue is how do I make the teddy bear? You know, and I finally figured it out. And the software is kind of a non-intuitive cross between Photoshop and Illustrator, Adobe Illustrator. Each shape you make, whether it's a line or a closed shape, is an object. And you get to move them around. So each of them is a layer. Once I figured that out, that opened my eyes. I could begin to do gradients and combine gradients to get different kinds of optical color mixes. And then I investigated the thread a little bit more. I use mainly polyester thread, and it's a trilobal polyester thread. And I said, trilobal? Oh, it's basically a triangular shape cross section. And so what that means is that when light hits a surface, it reflects back a color. Depending on the angle of that light, the color shifts. You've got a triangular surface, you're going to get of that blue on Donald Duck's coat, you're going to get a variety of blues reflected back to you because of the angle of the light. And that's why his blue was so ultramarine, because it was sparkling on different wavelengths. And once I understood that, I knew then if I folded the cloth also, I would give almost a lenticular effect, like those signs you walk by in one direction, it's sure. Joe Blow, right. And in the other direction, it's Jane Blow. Well, color-wise, you can kind of do that when you're using the folds. And so I started working with permanent folds and working with the colors to see what they would do. And when you walk by these things, you get a broader rainbow of color than I ever used. So the piece that you guys can see, I think, has three colors in it. And if you're in front of it, when you walk along it, you're seeing more like four or five. And it's because of the folds.
And the interplay.
And they play with the light, which is a lot like Old Master's oils.
Oh, sure.
The layering.
The layering there and the light passing through all those lovely linseed oil layers to reflect off of the various layers and scatter.
So with all your different artistic interests, this is just a nuts and bolts question. Sure. How do you set up your studio? Do you have multiple projects going at once? And so how do you organize your day then, I guess?
My day usually starts at the computer, you know, putting out the email fires, you know, the brush fires, and doing inventory and, you know, things like that. So most of the morning is usually spent on the computer, and the afternoon, on the best day in the world, is all spent with my hands and tools and things. I now have, I actually have three embroidery machines. The original one sits under my table. I just take it to the cottage with me. It's a terrible machine. But I have a large commercial machine now that I can stitch things that are almost 48 inches wide by 20 inches tall. It's unusually large. And so that takes up a lot of space, but I can produce on that machine and on my machine that does 11 inches, lots of modules that I then can work with little by little. And then the basement has the wood shop, for building armatures or for carving down, cutting and carving down walnut, which I've been doing lately. It's so beautiful. I love it.
You're listening to Art on the Air with our guest today, Susan Hensel, on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
But I tend to, I can't even count how many projects at once.
And so do you work on multiple ones per day, or are you like...
Yeah, it depends on the day. Right now I am physically limited a little bit, so I'm lucky to work on one. I had a really nasty injury last April. It's going to take me until probably next April to be... Oh, it's just one of those stupid things that bodies do. It's just dumb. But it's usually... I concentrate on one, like yesterday and a little bit of today before I saw you, between physical therapy and seeing you, I was working on a 96-inch armature that will hold the fabric that I completed probably 3 weeks ago, but I had to get strong enough to build the armature.
Mm.
So I built the armature, and all that's left to do on it now is to put the hanging hardware on it, then I can turn it over and I can attach the fabric. There's another one waiting on the wall for me that is attached to itself, but it needs finishing on the back. So that one's waiting for me. And I probably have, I have another one that I have to build another armature for. And I have gazillions in my computer waiting to be stitched out and played with. And I also keep all the, you know, I keep the offcuts. There's a lot of waste in this that is appalling because it is all polyester and I will not send that to the landfill. So I donate a fair amount of stuff to education. So that works there. And then the things that come out where, you know, you hit the wrong button, so it came out blue instead of pink, you know, things like that, user error, but they're still useful at some point. And so I have boxes that are sorted more or less by color so that when I want to go back to things, I can go back and go, oh, that wasn't as bad as I thought. Or, oh, what if I cut it across the middle and attached it to this thing over here? Or what if I combined it with works on paper? How would that work? So I try not to waste anything. I try really hard not to. And then I love plumbing stores, you know, finding little brass screens and washers and things for adding a little more bling at times. Those are fun.
So. I agree. Hardware stores are amazing. Especially the old farm. Old ones are just phenomenal.
They're just the best. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In Northwest Indiana, we have a hardware store. Well, it's an old hardware store that's an art gallery now. And they still have a lot of the old bins of things up in this Paul Henry Gallery. Now it's called Paul Henry Gallery. It's Paul Henry Hardware, but it was a classic. Yeah. And so they converted it to an art gallery, and they have things, and they have music and events there also. But the floor is a piece of art itself. It's a wood floor, and they used to also mix different kinds of paint. And there's all these spatters of paint all over.
Yeah.
And I know some of my artist friends have taken photos of people like laying on the floor and taking the patterns, just the random patterns of all the years of paint. So
yeah, there's also I think it's in Indiana somewhere. There is an old like five and dime that was converted to a residency. And what artists get to do is they come in and they make from whatever is in there, which I've always thought is a really cool idea. So maybe the John Henry used to be this residency. I never know. But it's just, these things are wonderful. And I have one of those floors too. This place used to be a bakery. It used to be a ceramic studio for poured ceramics. We don't know what all it's been. It was a general store when it was built over 100 years ago. Yeah, things like that. So,
wow, that's an amazing history.
Yeah, yeah. Tin ceilings, the whole nine yards. So,
is there something you haven't done that you're wanting to do in art? Something other type of thing you want to explore that you haven't, you know, ventured on? You know, you master one thing, master another thing, and, you know, move on to something else.
And I'll add to that. Is there some place that you want to show that you're working toward developing?
I'm working toward a gallery representation in at least a B-level gallery, you know, East Coast, with support, you know, for the marketing. I'm a good marketer, but, you know, sometimes we need help.
Right.
But I also, yeah, I want to do, I think that I will at some point be adding on 3D modeling. It's kind of a natural next step for me, especially in the nylon type plastics, because they're so sensuous, those white plastics. And I think they will combine well with the embroidery. And I don't want to do bronze casting. I didn't like bronze casting, but I would like to experiment with taking some of these things and getting them cast to see what the texture will look like in metal. Because sometimes that's an interesting thing to look into.
Have you done any work in metal? Not just adding your doodads and things that you got at the hardware store, but actually working with metal at all?
Not really since college. It was not the right material for me. I definitely did bronze casting, and I built using just galvanized, and I can use galvanized without driving myself too nuts, using galvanized to make a nice flowing thing that sat on the stairs. So, you know, I can do basic metal work, but no, I don't really want to do welding. I don't really want to be in the studio with the bronze furnaces. It's just not quite my thing. For one thing, I got real sick from it, because everybody does, and it's like, that's stupid. So,
I know the first time I worked with brass, I became horribly ill, and I just said, "This is not for me."
It's not with it. No. Most of the foundries don't have enough ventilation, and it's avoidable. You don't have to get sick, you know, but they don't have the ventilation.
Do you teach your technique to anyone in your studio? I mean, do you have? I mean, whether formal classes or maybe informal things, or maybe even online.
Mainly I do open houses at this point and critique groups. Otherwise, I am a mentor, and I am mentoring one artist now. And for her, it's about keeping her on target. She knows where she wants to go, which isn't very far. She just wants a few shows a year locally. That's fine. But she wants to develop bodies of work, and she needs to recognize how they go together, and she wants accountability. I have another person who's going to start with me in November, and she wants to work on work-life balance as well as marketing. She's a recent MFA in photography who I met. And so I do that periodically, and I really love mentoring. I mentored through a foundation called Art to Change the World, which was a great deal of fun. It combined an artist and a scientist with an artist, theater or otherwise. And I had a statistician, had me, and we had Lauren, who was a theater person, and she developed a festival. And we helped her stay on target, but she was so competent, she didn't need much. So they trained her well in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So, yeah. Enjoy doing that.
And along that line, what general advice would you give to someone in terms of their art practice, marketing, getting out there? How, you know, just some quick advice.
Well, the first thing is you got to make the work. Just show up. You got 5 minutes, use 5 minutes, period. I had 5 minutes. I painted my armature. So always show up. Even you don't have to wait for inspiration. Just be in your studio. And if your studio is the corner of the kitchen, that's fine. Let anyone else use it. That's your studio. Take it seriously and just be there.
And if all you're doing it. I mean, the doing it will lead to the other ideas.
Exactly. And then the next step is you got to show it to somebody. For the art to do its work in the world, you got to share it. Mm. Now, for some people, it really is only about their internal work, and that's fine. But when you run out of people, you know, friends and family to give it to, then you sometimes have to reach out farther. So you start doing art fairs and festivals and applying for local shows and regional shows and all of that. And don't be scared. You know, we all get rejected.
Right.
All of us.
Oh, it's so true. So how can people see your work, Susan?
You have some exhibits coming up.
Yeah, right. I have a bunch of exhibits coming up. I have a group of works that in various formations are traveling. And the first one is going to be at the Hopkins Center for the Arts, October 27th through December 3rd. And that's a very large show. It's going to have 35 or 40 pieces in it. I'm calling it Bending Toward Beauty, but it turns out they renamed it to At Play in the Fields of Color, which is fine. And it's moving then on to the Duluth Art Institute in Duluth, Minnesota in December through March. And then it's moving to the Springfield Art Association in Springfield, Illinois next May. But you can always find me online at SusanHenselProjects.com. And on Instagram, look up Susan Hensel Multimedia Artist. I post there all the time, and I post the gallery work there too for the people I represent. So I'm real available online.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. That's Susan Hensel from Minnesota, but widely traveled, obviously. Thank you so much for sharing your art and art practice with our audience.
Yes, it's been an extreme pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure for me as well. Have a wonderful, wonderful day. It's glorious here.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We would like to thank our current supporters and underwriters, which include regional art patron Mary Levan and Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.